This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, glad to have you along today. This is Evan Fowler. I'm the Director of Operations for Bot Radio Network, and I have the occasional pleasure and privilege of sitting in for Tony Perkins, and I'm doing that today. Friday is my favorite day of the week. After a great week of work, it's time to relax a little bit and maybe do some work at home and then have that great day Sunday, a day of rest, a Sabbath. So glad to have you along this afternoon. As usual, we've got a very filled show today, lots of good topics, and I'm going to tell you what they are. First of all, on deck, North Korea is still in the news, of course, a big, big, important story, and President Trump continues to talk tough, which he probably should do. We're going to be talking with Gordon Chang here in just a couple of minutes. He's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World and the Coming Collapse of China. He's also a Stanford University professor. In Kansas, a doctor who performed an abortion on a 13-year-old, this is almost unthinkable, at a Planned Parenthood clinic is under investigation. Mary Kay Culp, executive director of Kansans for Life, will join us to explain what's going on there. Water cooler conversations continue about the fired Google employee and his diversity manifesto. Curtis Houck, managing editor of Newsbusters, will chime in on how the mainstream media has covered his memo. Jerry Johnson talked a little bit about this topic yesterday, but we're going to take a couple of different steps and go in a little bit different direction on this very interesting topic that's in the news. And finally, in our final segment, a foster care couple is battling the state of Michigan. A Marine veteran says he had to give up carrying his concealed firearm under duress to keep his grandson. Dave Workman with the Second Amendment Foundation, and the Second Amendment Foundation is filing a lawsuit on his behalf, will be with us, and he'll take your calls if we have time, although that's going to be a pretty packed segment. We will give the phone number at that point. So here we are. President Trump is sending a strong message to North Korea. Trump took to Twitter this morning saying, quote, "Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely." As you can imagine, some think the president's comments are too strong, but others say it's about time to get tough with North Korea. Before we get into our first discussion here with Gordon Chang, I'd like to play a little bit of audio from President Trump. Brent, if you could roll that cut for us.
If anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough. And we're backed by 100% by our military. We're backed by everybody. And we're backed by many other leaders. And I noticed that many senators and others today came out very much in favor of what I said. But if anything, that statement may not be tough enough.
What would be tougher than fire and fury?
Well, you'll see. You'll see. I'm not like the other administration that would say we're going into Mosul in 4 months. I don't talk about it. We'll see what happens. But I can tell you that what they've been doing and what they've been getting away with is a tragedy, and it can't be allowed.
Well, joining us now is Gordon Chang, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, thanks for joining us here on Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Well, my first question to you is, what do you think? There's been a lot of comment about the things that the president has been saying publicly in a news conference he had and on Twitter. Do you think what he's saying is appropriate, first of all?
Well, of course, military options should always be on the table. We should never take them off. This administration wouldn't do it. Of course, the previous administrations, that's consistent with American foreign policy. The thing that I'm concerned about is that war talk is just dominating the airwaves. And indeed, at this point, there are so many non-kinetic things that we can do, short of the use of force, to disarm North Korea. We're not talking about those since the Security Council resolution of last Saturday. And indeed, I think that we have an obligation to try to solve this without starting history's next great conflict.
You know, if you, as I have kind of looked at this thing across the board, you have, of course, the president with some very strong rhetoric, and then you have Rex Tillerson presenting, I would say, some balance to that with the things that he's saying. And of course, that's interpreted by the media as, well, they don't have any strategy. And then you have the Secretary of Defense, who's also saying some things. His words are not as strong, but he's kind of an understated guy. And he's saying, you know, if we need to go that route, we're ready. So, you know, in your view, well, first of all, in terms of some of the views that people are saying, well, they don't really have a strategy, I really wonder if that's the case. What do you think?
Well, the Trump administration has a strategy, and we've seen outlines of it. For instance, in the last part of June, they imposed costs on China. These were small punishments, and indeed they were a signal to Beijing that the Chinese needed to come to the party. The administration, of course, has pursued that. I think that President Trump at the G20 in Hamburg, when he spoke to Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, amplified those messages. So there is a strategy. We are, of course, talking in an administration which does speak in many voices, and I think the president needs to exercise some message discipline. But what I would do in terms of going forward is that I would tone down the rhetoric but amp up the pressure. There's a lot of pressure that we're not putting on the North Koreans, and there's a lot of pressure we have not put on the Chinese. And I think that we really need to do that because there are, as I said, things that we can do to disarm North Korea without use of force. So, for instance, one of the things we can do is try to deny the regime all of the resources that have been pouring into North Korea that they use to build nukes and ballistic missiles. So, for instance, we know that Chinese banks have been money laundering for the North Koreans. We know the names of countries that have been sending money to North Korea because of their economic relations. These are illicit. They violate Security Council resolutions. They violate all sorts of norms of good order. And yet the United States is not going after them. And indeed, when the history of this period is written, people are going to ask why the U.S. did not use all the elements of national power. And it's not just this administration. It's the ones before them. So we can do things, and I think that we should amp up the pressure and perhaps talk a little bit less about the use of force.
Well, let me ask you, too. Let's say that the United States was doing or is doing all of the things that you recommended, because you hear sort of wisps of information coming out that would indicate that maybe some of those things are going on in the background. If they were going on, would we even necessarily know the details? I doubt it, but I'm wondering what you think about that.
I'm sure that there are back-channel conversations we're having with Beijing, but the types of things I'm talking about indeed are enforcing U.S. law. When President Trump took the oath of office on January 20, he promised to uphold the Constitution. And part of upholding the Constitution is enforcing U.S. law. Yet we've allowed, for instance, Chinese and other banks to use the U.S. financial system in ways which violate, for instance, the Patriot Act, that they're indeed criminal, the money laundering. And I don't see the administration moving against the larger institutions. To its great credit, the Trump administration used the Patriot Act against a small fry Chinese institution, but since then has not moved against the larger Chinese banks also involved in the same crime and money laundering for North Korea. So these things we would know about. We know that the administration hasn't employed these pressure tactics, and I'd like to see them do that because I think they have the potential of suffocating the North Korean regime.
Well, you've studied North Korea for a long time, and this is something that I've kind of wondered about, and it takes us back to some of what is called, you know, President Trump's rhetoric and the tough talk. And that is, I have kind of wondered if our military folks do a little bit of digging into perhaps the psychological background of Kim, and that they may know sort of how to push his buttons, and wondering if maybe some of this rhetoric is designed specifically to deal with that individual. What do you think?
I think that no American official has ever talked to Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader. The only American who's had any contact with him at all or any substantial contact is Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm not sure that we understand the psychology of Kim. But indeed, when we look at Kim, he operates under incentives which are very different from those in our country and in other places. And so I think it's going to be hard for us to understand him. What President Trump has done with his rhetoric, and these are good things, at least in substance, is that he's reinforced the notion of deterrence, and he's also told the Chinese that there is a very limited time in which they can solve this. And indeed, the Chinese can solve this. They can disarm North Korea if they want to. They haven't wanted to for various reasons, and many of those reasons, I think, undercut good order. So there's a lot that the administration can do, and I think that part of the rhetoric is indeed talking to the Chinese, giving them a sense of urgency.
Well, yeah. Speaking of the Chinese, what are some of the key incentives for them to take some action and slow this thing down or stop it?
There are no incentives so far, or very few incentives that the U.S. has given to China to solve this. For decades, our policy with regard to China was to integrate it into the international system. And we placed that goal far above disarming North Korea. So what we got were some very arrogant Chinese because we fed their notions of self-importance. And we also got a nuked-up North Korea, really the worst of all possible worlds. What we haven't done up until at least the last week of June, when the Trump administration did impose some small punishments on China, what we haven't done is impose those costs. We have overwhelming leverage over the Chinese, and we have failed to exercise that. And so, indeed, they don't have an incentive to do the right thing, and it's really not their fault. It's our fault for not imposing those costs on China. So, for instance, they've been transferring crucial equipment for North Korea's ballistic missile program. The launchers that the North Koreans used on July 4th and July 28th were their intercontinental ballistic missile launches. Those are Chinese. It appears that North Korea's most advanced missiles, far more advanced than the ones they launched last month, are Chinese in origin, based on the JL-1 submarine launch missile of China. We haven't talked to the Chinese, as far as I can tell, about the transfer of all of this, except in ways which were very desultory. So, you know, in a sense, we have allowed the Chinese to arm the North Koreans, and we say, in effect, oh, that's okay. We're not going to do anything. And that's our fault.
Well, let's talk a little bit about missiles, because that's really one of the big things that that this is all about. With respect to our own technology, you know, Kim has threatened to launch four missiles toward Guam, and who knows if it's a real threat or not. If that were to happen, what is the probability that our technology could take those out before they reach the ground?
It depends whether we put our ships in place near the North Korean coast, because that would help us. We have excellent, we have state-of-the-art, the world's best technology for shooting down missiles. But the reason why the North Koreans are launching four missiles, I think, is to say that no matter how good our anti-missile systems are, the North Koreans can overwhelm them. So, for instance, we have 36 interceptors based in Alaska and California. And even if they had a 100% kill ratio, and they don't, by the way, but even if they did, all the North Koreans need to do is launch 37 missiles.
That's right.
They overwhelm our system. So, as good as it is, until we have directed energy weapons with unlimited reloads, we're always going to be behind the ball, because trying to kill a missile, a bullet with a bullet, which is how our missile defense experts put it, it's really, really hard. And if you miss, you only have to miss once for there to be a disaster.
Gordon Chang, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, thanks for taking time today on Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Evan. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up next, a Planned Parenthood doctor is being investigated for doing an abortion on a 13-year-old.
Is there a cost to free speech? For nearly 40 years, Washington and much of the American public have held up disclosure and campaign finance laws as ideals and the path to cleaner and freer elections. In her book, The Intimidation Game, Kimberly Strassel provides firsthand accounts concerning how both have been hijacked by the left as weapons against free speech and free association, becoming the most powerful tools of those intent on silencing their political opposition. The book provides a chilling expose of political scare tactics and overreach, such as how Citizens United set off a wave of liberal harassment against conservative politicians and the targeting of Tea Party groups by the IRS. Listen to Ms. Strassel as she discusses about her national bestseller, The Intimidation Game, How the Left is Silencing Free Speech, which chronicles recent attacks on conservative nonprofits, businesses, and donors at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
It's Truth for Youth Bible Week. This week, we're partnering with Revival Fires International to give away thousands of Truth for Youth Bibles. You can have one if you promise to pass it on to a student that you suspect doesn't know Christ.
We saw so many lives changed and seeds planted in the hearts of our students.
It's like, man, I really like the Truth for Youth Bible. How do I get to your church?
Each Bible consists of the entire New Testament, along with 100 pages of comics dealing with the truth about issues of moral concern.
I read some of the comics and they really touched my heart.
Parents, order a free Truth for Youth Bible for your teen to give to a friend. Or teens, you can order a Bible for a friend. They're even available in Spanish. Visit revivalfires.com or call 800-733-4737 between 8 and 4:30 Central Time. That's 800-733-4737. Let's take the message of the gospel to America's youth.
Jess's parents were divorced and she was angry and rebellious. At age 17, she got pregnant with a much older guy. Hi, Kim Katola for Cradle My Heart Today. And although her initial reaction was to get angry at God for allowing the pregnancy, Jess tells Pregnancy Help News that conversations with her dad, with her mom, and with her pastor provided a key that allowed the Holy Spirit beyond her heart's walls. Jess knew she couldn't marry this man and didn't want to repeat the stress of a two-household upbringing in her child's life, so she made an adoption plan. There was a custody battle and a false start with a family who returned little Zoe because she was deaf. But within months, a deaf family adopted Zoe and provided the perfect family setting within which she could thrive. Find out more of Jess's story and adoption resources at CradleMyHeart.org. Saving lives and healing hearts after abortion, one story at a time. CradleMyHeart.org.
You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in for Tony Perkins today. At T Perkins is Tony's Twitter handle, frc.org/radio. If you want to go back and listen to previous programs or listen to something you might have missed today, we're glad you're listening today. Next topic, a doctor facing possible disciplinary action over allegations that he broke Kansas law in handling a 13-year-old girl's abortion at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Overland Park, Kansas, told medical regulators Thursday that he was unaware of the patient's age and that the clinic staff was to blame. Joining us now is Mary Kay Culp, a good friend. She's the executive director of Kansans for Life. Mary Kay, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Evan, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot. I've interviewed you many times over the past number of years, but this is the first time we've put it together here on Washington Watch. So glad you're with us.
Okay, I'm glad to be here.
Well, the first question I want to ask you is, how common is it for abortions to be done on girls this young, 13 years old, for goodness sake?
Well, I didn't check before I looked, but I know about 10 years ago, there were 161 over a two-year period. And so, you know, unfortunately, more common than we'd like to think about.
So this... tell us the story. Give us the background on this. This abortion occurred somewhere 2014, as I recall. Tell us the story.
Well, listen, it's really disturbing to learn about these kinds of events when Kansas already passed the protective law, which are either not in effect or they've been ignored. This is a case with a lot of disturbing information and accusations between the abortion business and the doctor who performed the abortions by a state board that can only discipline the doctor, not the abortion business. Because after 10 years of trying and two vetoes by then-Kansas Governor Sebelius, which many of your listeners may remember her, Kansas passed the Abortion Clinic License Inspection and Reporting Law in 2011, the first year Sam Brownback was governor, but the provisions were unfairly blocked in the courts, in the state district court, before they could go into effect, and they remain so now, 6 years later. But that law would have allowed scheduled and unscheduled on-site inspections, including review of the abortion clinic's records, something the medical board can't do. So whether the case at hand is an outlier or typical is something only the health department, under the blocked law, can determine because, again, the medical board that held a hearing yesterday does not have that power. It's kind of a he said, she said, which is unusual between the abortion clinic and one of their doctors. And so basically, due to the state's history with the abortion industry, Kansas also passed two-parent consent for minors under Brownback. Yesterday's hearing didn't shed any light on that, and we have no way of knowing if that law was obeyed or disobeyed for this individual who's 13 years old. Now, the abortion industry fights state oversight, but our fear here in Kansas, as Evan, as I'm sure you know, that there's an impending ruling by our state Supreme Court that still contains a Sebelius majority, which is likely to enshrine abortion in our state constitution in a breathtaking way, much broader than Roe versus Wade. Because even under Roe, states are permitted to regulate the abortion industry to protect women and unborn children. But if our Supreme Court rules the way we're scared they're going to rule, Kansas will not even be allowed to ban partial birth or dismemberment abortion, much less have these kind of regulations, where that's possible through lawsuits that will happen over laws we've already passed. So,
let me go back. Let me ask you a question about, because you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago the regulations, the reporting regulations. Is that not kind of the essence of this complaint, that the doctor, because this girl was under below a certain age, he or the abortion clinic were required to do certain reporting?
Well, that they were, yes. That is part of it. But there's just so many confusing questions right now, and you have the doctor and the abortion clinic going back and forth against each other, and you really can't tell where the truth lies. So what I'm trying to say is, if our law that has been held in court for 6 years was in effect, the health department, which can have a much more punitive effect, not just on the doctor but on the clinic, would go in there and they would have the right to look at the records and see. Right now, it's really hard to tell what's going on because of the way the two of them are going against each other.
Well, and that's kind of the way Planned Parenthood likes it. The less transparency, the better, as far as they're concerned. Well, I understand, though, that this doctor is no longer providing abortions at this Planned Parenthood. Is that the case? And if so, what's that? What does that mean?
Not only that, but he said he's going to let his license disappear. It's up for renewal in October. He's not going to renew it. He said he's working part-time now for a wound care agency in Missouri. He's just concerned that this doesn't affect that. Our lobbyist was there at the hearing yesterday, so there's information. She took great notes, and there's information that's not even in the news stories that she was able to get yesterday.
All right, so you said that there's some controversy between this doctor, so-called doctor. I usually do not refer to abortionists as doctors, even if they might have an MD after their name. But this this individual who performed the abortion is saying the staff should have told him, and the staff is saying, no, you should have asked. So what's, we've got about a minute left here, but dig into that.
That'll be up to the Board of Healing Arts to decide. You know, he's saying, I never did abortion on minors. They had another doctor that took care of that, and then they brought a minor in and didn't tell me. And so he has his argument. They have their argument. We'll see what the board says. And by the way, can I just finish by saying, Evan, you and I met at a National Right to Life convention years ago. And Kansas is going to host the National Right to Life Convention here in Overland Park next summer, end of June. So
I just That's right. Tell us about that.
Get my commercial in there.
No, please do.
Well, and I went to the National Convention this year where the vice president was supposed to speak, but he had to stay in Washington because of the health care bill. So we're hoping that, you know, that maybe he'll come to Kansas. This will be the first one in Kansas. And we're having people like the woman and the man who made the Gosnell movie. And also there's going to be 60 workshops and a prayer breakfast and a banquet and special sessions and a teen convention, Teens for Life convention that goes along with it. So all they have to do is keep track with KFL.org over the year and our National Right to Life and come on over. Come see
us. You know, and that just highlights, Mary Kay, the important work that organizations like Kansans for Life do and National Right to Life. As we're sitting here talking about, you know, this awful situation where a 13-year-old girl is having an abortion, and then we're having all these court arguments and so on and so forth. We need to continue this fight, and we need to make abortion unthinkable. So thank you, Mary Kay, for the work that you're doing.
Hey, Evan, thank you so much, and thank Mr. Perkins for letting us talk today.
Absolutely. Coming up next, lots of chatter about a fired Google employee and his diversity manifesto. We'll talk with Curtis Houck, managing editor of Newsbusters, on how the media is responding Right after the break, you're listening to Washington Watch. This is Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Glad to have you along. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Well, U.S. stock indices continue to see downturns. We had three down days. Dow industrial averages continue to tumble, tumbled more than 200 points on Thursday. And looks like that there continues to be a great deal of concern about the war of words between President Trump and the North Korean leader. Asia markets tumbling on all of these words, bracing for more provocations from the regime in North Korea. So we'll see. We'll watch Asia stocks in particular, and keep in mind that's the entire Pacific Rim struggling with concerns. Well, on a better note, Donald Trump has laid out a path for Senate Majority Leader, I use that word loosely, Mitch McConnell, to get back in his good graces. Let's replace Obamacare, overhaul the U.S. tax code, and find a way to pay for big infrastructure improvements. That's the agenda of President Trump that he has laid on Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell, of course, wanting to get back into the good graces of Donald Trump. He is going to have to get something done, not based on the do-nothing, disjointed Republican Party, but he's going to have to get something done that is going to look like working and moving forward on a pro growth agenda.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
Well, in case you didn't know it, you've happened upon the Washington Watch broadcast. It is the radio broadcast of the Family Research Council. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. A fired Google employee has folks buzzing on both sides of the ideological aisle about his diversity memo. Controversy started when Google engineer James Damore wrote a 10-page memo expressing personal opinions about differences between men and women, and in particular, an analysis of why there are fewer women in the tech industry. And, of course, the mainstream media is in turmoil over the incident. Most of them probably didn't read it. I didn't read the whole thing, but I did take some time to read parts of it, and you know, it was pretty reasonable stuff. I didn't necessarily agree with everything he said, but it opened a discussion that we need to have about all this crazy diversity stuff and corporations who have to have vice presidents of diversity and all that sort of thing. Well, with us now is Curtis Houck. He's the managing editor of Newsbusters, and he's going to give us an overview of how the mainstream media has responded to the story. Curtis, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you.
All right. Well, how is the media reacting to this?
Well, it's been pretty interesting. They kind of set the tone right away. So this memo kind of gained public prominence about Monday afternoon, Monday evening thereabout. And right away you had the CBS Evening News saying that it was a setback for diversity. Well, that setback, I guess, in their mind was quickly alleviated by by his firing. And since then, it's such critics, you know, people raising questions and asking, you know, having concerns like the ones that we have as conservatives and Christians, is just being completely, smeared and ill-framed as just a bunch of alt-right neo-Nazis having some concerns. And, it's gotten pretty ridiculous. You have the New Republic writer the other day comparing James Damore to a privileged individual, you know, and talking about vaccines, I think this is another example of the media's misrepresentation of conservatives and a chance for them to deny science, just like they do with abortion, but they insult us for supposedly not following along on with climate change. So there's a number of things here that we can unpack, but I just think with the media is concerned, they're going right along with this, full speed ahead here, and they're not really raising the questions and concerns about censorship and free speech that I think they should be as the people who claim to love the First Amendment.
Well, you know, it's a great opportunity. Again, as I read it, and I'm sure you have read it as well, James Damore brings up some very important points that it would really be nice if people would actually have the courage to talk about. And as I said, probably most of the media commentators who commented on it, but particularly those who read stories about it and then comment about it but don't read the original article, they're totally uninformed about what the individual said. And I found it interesting, too, that both the chief diversity officer, and I may not have her title exactly right, from Google, as well as the CEO of Google, said some things that were rather interesting and directly contradictory, where sort of in the first sentence they say, well, here at Google, you know, we respect the diversity of opinion. We want to hear what people think. You know, you have a right to speak out. But then we're going to fire the guy who did that because he violated some policies that we have. What do you think about that one?
I know, right? It's just if this wasn't, you know, the idea of censorship wasn't such a serious subject, you would just chalk it up to a comedy of errors here. You know, they were supposed to have a town hall yesterday to talk about what was going on, and yet that guy canceled right beforehand, and then they sent out a letter afterwards saying that, you know, everything's fine, you know, pretty much, you know, nothing to see here, everything's okay. And again, you know, there's so much that they need to put to rest. They have, you know, reports of Google employees supporting what this young gentleman said. And again, you know, you pointed out really well, he was a little inartful in some of his ways, but, you know, this guy's a tech person. He doesn't write for a living. So, you know, that can kind of explain a lot of it there. But you have the media then, you know, like CNN's Brooke Baldwin did a few days ago on the 9th, say this guy's memo basically suggested that women shouldn't be allowed to have computers. I mean, that is just a complete distortion of what his memo said. His memo was trying to say, why aren't there women in tech?
Right.
Not that we should take that, you know, computers away from women because they can't handle it because they're too psychotic.
No, in fact,
that's totally not what he's saying.
Yeah, in fact, in this memo, he actually presented some ideas to Google to help them, based on the discussion that he put forth in this memo, to help them think of ways that they might be able to attract more women to the tech world. So he was giving some practical suggestions, and that's not mentioned in very many of the reports at all.
Yeah, it sounded like it was just a rant and a manifesto when he laid out, you know, very... You know, he laid out a problem, he proposed solutions, which I think is how most people go about things when they disagree with something or they're trying to write it. You know, even this is what's taught in school when you try to write a persuasive essay. This is what teachers teach. You lay out, you know, you state your problem or whatever and how you want to fix it or why people should come around to believe what you think. I mean, this is you know, persuasion and opinion 101 here. And yet that was too much for Google. That was a line too far for Silicon Valley. Because supposedly, you know, again, this is the group mentality of, you know, liberal secularism, where everyone thinks the same way, and that a certain way is a religion. And that's what this has shown once and again, you know, something that a lot of us know, but, and just for the public to see, you know, that the left is alive and well out there in California, and that a diversity of thought is not allowed. And if there is, they are kind of marginalized as alt-right, crazy, neo-Nazi, and not providing any sort of sober point.
Curtis, we've got to go. Curtis Houck, managing editor of Newsbusters, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Coming up next, a Marine veteran says he had to give up carrying his concealed firearm under duress because he wanted to be a foster parent. That's in the state of Michigan. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Coming right back.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. One of the places we visit on one of the days on our tour of Israel is the Shepherd's Fields. Now, this is a place in Bethlehem. You can look out on any given day and see shepherds with their sheep, as if it were 2,000 years ago during the birth of Christ. So that's a very special place that we visit. Yeah, the terrain would be the same. You can just picture yourself being there the night the angels sang about the glory of the coming of the Lord. That's just one of the places we visit on one of the days. So if you would like to join us on our March 8th through the 16th tour of Israel, we'd love to have you. Just go to the website, twholyland.com, for more information. twholyland.com. Or for a free brochure sent to you in the mail, call us at 800-FAMILIES. That's 1-800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, option 5.
Friendships. An all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished. Friendships is now taking applications for crew members who have a heart for helping people and are able to serve without pay. Visit friendships.org to learn how you could be a part of the crew reaching out to help people in need here at home and abroad. That's friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Many in America seem to have forgotten that its foundation was built on God. In this 40th year celebration of the American Family Association, we invite you to help us remind America once again of the truth behind our national motto, In God We Trust. You can do your part and display your faith with an In God We Trust car decal from the AFA store. Order yours today with free shipping at afastore.net. That's afastore.net.
Here for your encouragement and your walk with God. This is David Wolin with Haven Ministries, inviting you to anchor your day in God's Word. Most Christians want to please God and avoid sin, but it's not so easy. Our sin nature is at war inside of us, enticing us to desire what's wrong, which is why we're called to resist the devil and flee from sin. But let me ask you, what's your motivation for resisting sin? Are you trying to earn points with God? Or hoping your obedience means you'll get something in return? If so, you've missed the gospel. If you belong to Jesus, His righteousness has become your own. And instead, your motivation can be the same as the Apostle Paul's. He once wrote, "Christ's love compels us, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for Him who died for them." Get Anchor devotional in print every month. Visit getanchor.com.
You're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network sitting in today for Tony Perkins, and we're glad to have you along. When the state of Michigan asked William and Jill Johnson, a retired Marine and his wife, to be foster parents, they readily agreed it. After all, it was hard to say no because the child in question was their grandson, and the alternative was for him to go into foster care. So William has a concealed carry permit and says he's been forced to give up carrying his firearm under duress. Essentially, the state is telling him, you know, you can either be a foster parent or you can continue to exercise your constitutional rights. Well, with us now is Dave Workman, senior editor of The Gun Mag, a publication of the Second Amendment Foundation, and co-author of several books with Alan Gottlieb, including the recent Right to Carry. And by the way, Dave is also a good guy with a gun. Dave, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, it's very kind of you to invite me on board here. It's an interesting case that we're going to be discussing here.
Let me jump in here for the first rodeo
for the Second Amendment Foundation on this subject.
No, not at all. And if we have a couple of minutes, I'd like to have you get into that a little bit. But first of all, let me put out the phone number. And Dave, if we have any time left, we'll ask listeners to call in 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. Well, Dave, I understand the Second Amendment Foundation has filed a federal lawsuit against the head of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services on behalf of these foster parents. Tell us about, first of all, tell us what transpired that brought them to the point of having to come to the Second Amendment Foundation.
Well, it's my understanding that over the course of getting this set up, the Johnsons and another couple, Brian and Naomi Mason, had some experience with the Michigan Department of, Health and Human Services.
Right.
And what they were told, especially the Johnsons, who, as you correctly explained, had been asked to foster their their grandson, apparently he had been taken from his mom. So in order to keep his in the family, making a long story short, they went in for an interview. At the time of the interview, it's my understanding that Mr. Johnson was frisked. He was searched to see if he was carrying a firearm because they were having this meeting in a state building someplace. Under Michigan statute, I guess you can't carry in a state building. And, of course, those laws change from state to state. In some states, you can. Here in Washington State, where I'm at, for example, you can actually carry a concealed firearm inside the Capitol building. You just can't carry one in the you can't carry openly in the House chambers or the Senate chambers.
Right.
So, you know, each state has a different set of laws, but no state that I know of, except for Michigan and maybe Illinois, and it used to be Oklahoma, but they solved that because of one of our lawsuits. The bureaucracies there don't just frown on foster parents having firearms. They really try to discourage it and even prevent it. And this is the case with Mr. and Mrs. Johnson. I've seen photographs of him fishing and doing some odd things, just carrying on day-to-day activities where he is openly carrying a sidearm. That's perfectly legal in Michigan, as I understand the state law. Long story short, again, the Johnsons felt they had no recourse. You shouldn't have to give up your Second Amendment rights, and it is a right, it's not a privilege, in order to care for your own grandson or for even for another foster child, simply because in the event of an attack or some criminal activity, how are you going to defend that child, much less yourself, if you don't have the tools to do it? And, of course, nobody in the bureaucracy really wants to address that issue. It's sort of a one-sided gun control thing. So the Second Amendment Foundation got involved here, and we're just going to see how this one shakes out.
Well, Dave, let me ask you this. Are they saying that Mr. Johnson, obviously they're saying that he can't carry concealed, even though he is legally permitted and all that sort of thing, but are they also saying that he can't even own firearms or have them in the home if this grandson is to be adopted?
Well, it's my understanding that there are some pretty stringent requirements on storage, safe storage in the home for foster or adoptive parents, but I think the acid test here is the right to carry. And right now there are some 16.3 or 4 million citizens licensed to carry across the United States. There are more than 600,000 of those citizens in the state of Michigan. And Michigan, in my experience, doesn't just hand those permits out like cookies and candy. You know, people go through a background check. The authorities make sure that they're not just handing a permit to carry to some bum out there. This is pretty rigorous standards, just like most every other state that issues licenses. So I think the problem here is not with a law, but with the way a bureaucracy wants to throw its weight around. We demonstrated, we meaning the Second Amendment Foundation, because they actually own the Gun Mag where I'm senior editor. The Second Amendment Foundation took the state of Oklahoma to court over this. Oklahoma changed the way it operated enough to satisfy the parameters of the lawsuit. There's another lawsuit going on in the state of Illinois on almost similar grounds to what the Michigan case is about. And it's my understanding, again, that a hearing on that is coming up next month. So we are going to perhaps see some new legal ground plowed here, and I think it'll be favorable to armed private citizens.
Well, one of the things that the Second Amendment Foundation has been involved in are a lot of major cases. You know, everybody has heard of the NRA. But I don't think everybody's heard of the Second Amendment Foundation. Touch on a couple of the major cases that that the organization, and Alan Gottlieb in particular, have been involved in that probably people have heard of.
Well, everybody, I think, has heard of McDonald v. City of Chicago. That was the legal action that went to the U.S. Supreme Court that essentially struck down the Chicago handgun ban. That was a Second Amendment Foundation case. It was a SAF victory. The case was argued before the Supreme Court by Alan Gura, who was also the attorney who argued the 2008 Heller case before the Supreme Court. And Gura won both of those cases.
Right.
All the gods and all the heavens, you know, for whatever reason, the media just doesn't pick up on this. I don't know whether it's deliberate or just lazy journalism, but for some reason, as you point out, it's typically they mention the National Rifle Association, which does a good job, but beyond that, I think their imagination sort of goes into a big black hole someplace. Because they don't flesh out the fact that there are several national gun rights organizations. Maybe they want to deny that because they just want to identify the Second Amendment movement as some big monolithic group that's based down in Virginia. That's not true. It's never been true. I know of at least four national gun rights organizations that operate essentially independent of one another.
You know what I found interesting, Dave, too, and we'll get back. I've got a couple more questions about this specific case in Michigan. But what I found interesting, and you made a point there about safe gun storage at home when you have children, and any responsible firearms owner needs to know and needs to make sure that they're doing that. And anybody who has half a brain cell operating will do that. But I find it's interesting that a lot of these organizations that are on the other side of the issue, like, and I can't even remember, but the ones that are funded by Michael Bloomberg and others, they talk about gun safety, but none of them that I know of, not a single one of them is actually doing anything to actually help with that. For instance, the National Rifle Association has tens of thousands of instructors who teach people how to safely use and store and care for firearms. But none of these organizations on the other side that constantly spout the need for gun safety, or as they love the term, common sense gun safety regulations. What they're talking about is registration, really, when it gets down to it. But none of them really lift a finger to do anything practical. Am I accurate there or not?
Oh, you're spot on. I think you just cracked the code. I retired, actually, from being a volunteer firearms instructor in February of this year because I've been doing it for 35 years, and quite frankly, I'm a dilapidated old guy, and I just don't have the time anymore.
Yeah.
But it's always been curious to me, and I've written about this as a journalist many, many times over the years, that when they talk about gun safety, that's just an out lie. They've substituted these different terms for control because control, gun control, is toxic politically in state legislatures and in Washington, D.C. It's just been that way on Capitol Hill. There are many pro-gun Republicans and many pro-gun Democrats who look at the term gun control, and they don't want to touch it with my hand. You know, it's just one of those things. But the gun prohibition movement, and I'm the one who coined that term a few years ago. It used to be a gun control deal, but they have come out of the closet, as it were. They have just pulled away the veil, and they've acknowledged time and again that they want to ban this gun or they want to ban that gun. They want to ban a whole class of firearms. They want to ban guns in certain areas. And to me, that's not gun control. That is gun prohibition. They just can't stand the idea of having to publicly admit that. So they come up with the Every Town for Gun Safety, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility. And none of these people knows the first thing about safety or responsibility. As you so perfectly pointed out, none of these organizations has ever offered a single firearm safety class. They have no certified instructors. They talk about responsibility, and in their terms, responsibility is not having a gun in the home and trying to take guns out of everybody else's home, too. So, you know, there we are.
Well, you know, and if they start to offer some of those courses, I'd be happy to teach the first one. And you probably would, too, you know.
I would come out of old crotchety retirement just to help them out a little bit.
There you go. Well, let me ask you, again, I'm going to try to get back to Michigan here for just a second, but I want to ask you about something that's been in the news quite a bit, and that is a national reciprocity bill, which means that if you have a concealed carry permit in State A, it is also, it's treated like a driver's license in all the other states, a national reciprocity bill. And there's a lot of There are a lot of states that are reciprocal depending upon where you live. Of course, if you live in Kansas or Missouri, there are many states that will recognize your permit. But there are some other ones like California, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, or No Jersey, as I call it, that don't. And I recently saw an article saying that, you know, that would be an easy, not necessarily an easy win in the Senate, but it's something that, to move forward and force a vote in the Senate so that the senators can show their colors. Trump would sign it for sure. Where are we on that one? We've got about 2 minutes, Dave.
Okay, well, the legislation has been gathering dust in the House of Representatives since it was introduced back in early January. I've written about this several times and reminded my readers that if they really want to make progress, they need to contact their senators and congressmen, who, by the way, are home this month on recess, or should be anyway. I think what is going on right now is what I've been talking about for weeks. We are seeing a demonstration of what Congress does best, which is absolutely nothing.
Yep. And, well, that's what President Trump's been saying about Mitch McConnell the last couple of days.
Well, yeah, you know, I've never met Mitch McConnell. He seems like a nice guy on TV, but, you know, he's, what, up in his 80s? Nobody should make a career in politics, maybe. I guess, you know, and I'm saying that as a journalist. I made a career in journalism, and maybe we shouldn't do that either. So,
yeah.
It stuns me, though, that people who rode into power on Capitol Hill, thanks to millions of gun owners who turn out every election, they don't seem to remember who brung them to the dance. At the very least, they should try to move this legislation and, as you say, put it up for a vote so that we can see who the good guys and the bad guys are.
Yeah, because there are actually a few pro-Second Amendment Democrats hanging around out there, a few, if they can actually break from the pack. Well, Dave, we've run out of time. Dave Workman is the senior editor of The Gun Mag. It's a publication of the Second Amendment Foundation. And if you're not familiar with the Second Amendment Foundation or The Gun Mag, and you're interested, go, you know, hit the Google and do it. Dave, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Have a good weekend.
Well, you've been listening to the Washington Watch broadcast. This is Eben Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.